I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Cities have always been hotbeds of innovation. Today, our guests offer perspectives on innovation both from the past and the future. Steel cities were once the very embodiment of innovation, and Dr. Kenneth Thompson, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh, is part of an international consortium of scholars and civic leaders who are attempting to understand the shared histories of steel cities and how they can draw on those histories to make a new future. Larry Keeley is helping urban leaders invent their cities' futures. In a series of urban innovation workshops staged earlier this year with CEOs for cities, Larry taught the methods of innovation to leaders in Pittsburgh, Detroit, Columbus, and Memphis, Shelby County. Innovation is our topic today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. Kenneth Thompson is an associate professor of psychiatry and public health at the University of Pittsburgh. Earlier this year, he attended the first International Steel Cities Conference. His report, Bonded by Steel, contains highlights of the shared histories, challenges, and opportunities for steel cities. Ken, last summer you participated with a group of scholars and policymakers working in steel cities around the world to consider the themes of tradition, transition, and transformation. What is it about the tradition of steel cities that made them loom so large in our imaginations?
The history of steel cities is one of, you know, basically early introduction of a mass industrial culture into what were agrarian cities. So it's an early form of mass industrial production that I think that the tradition shows up in a couple of ways. One is that they were described as horrible monstrosities, fearful places. Pittsburgh was described as hell with the lid off.
Oh my goodness!
And I didn't really quite understand that until at this conference we started to really contemplate, you know, what the rest of the world actually looked like in, say, 1870. And for the most part, in 1870, most of America was agrarian. People were still living in farms or maybe villages and a few large cities, but no place that smoked and belched and spewed fire all over the place. And you can imagine that when they came to see Pittsburgh and places that are like it, other steel cities, which at that point, you know, you have the massive growth of the steel industry in the United States and elsewhere, people came and they were really, it would almost be like going to another planet, I think. So the tradition of these cities is, one, starts off as being just very, very, very dangerous and scary places that at the same time began to produce incredible wealth and began to produce machines and things that were sort of unworldly, you know, things like the railways and capacity to build giant skyscrapers and things like this. So I think that part of the tradition is related to how people perceive these cities and what these cities were able to produce. But on top of that, another element of the tradition is the fact that they were, you know, large company towns. So people came and they worked in these places, and it was very difficult work, and it was dirty work, and it was dangerous work, and there was a lot of conflict about where the wealth would go as the steel is being produced. So they're places of sort of working class and bosses. And I think that there's an element of solidarity and conflict that occurs in that you know, you can see pretty much in the history of almost all of these cities. People ended up, as time evolved, sort of resolving some of those issues until the collapse, at least in Pittsburgh, where the working class folks, people who were coming out of high school and going into the mills, were coming out and up until the 1980s going into work making up to $20 an hour, which in those days was a lot of money. So there was a lot of wealth being transferred and a general sense that steel was going to write the ticket for generations to come.
Did the workers acquire the same characteristics of, you know, if they lived in dangerous, scary places and they produced unworldly, otherworldly things, how did the workers internalize that and reflect that?
You know, I think that there was a very, very strong culture of these mill towns. a lot of it was based on very strong ethnic ties. You know, one of the things that kind of picks up, I should pick up on the issue of the traditions, is that people weren't born to be steel workers until the 1860s, you know, and when suddenly there was a demand for this kind of labor, the call went out, and in the United States, but it turns out it's pretty much all over the place, essentially what you're doing is creating a whole new group of people who come to these places to make a living. In many ways, Western Pennsylvania, will just you know, with a focus on Pittsburgh as a prototypical steel town, became a you know, it's an odd thing to think of, but it was sort of the California of the of the last century. I mean, people just flocked here to go to work in these mills. They came from all over the world. And what we found talking with other places is that they might not necessarily have had quite as international a process, but they had people coming from out of the countryside into these towns, and they formed closely knit neighborhoods of real sort of community solidarity. And the people and the workers developed an image of themselves as very, very tough working people who were hardworking and who knew how to play pretty hard as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, what sort of legacy does that leave a city like Pittsburgh when the steel industry goes away? I mean, obviously there's a wrenching change. Does it leave a legacy that is both good and bad?
Well, I got interested in this because I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm particularly interested in what happens to communities and how groups of people deal with the adversities that life hands them. Pittsburgh and other steel cities of people we talked to where the mills had closed down and the plant had become old and the methods of production had gone out of date. And by the way, there were other places in the world that were willing to do it for less. Pittsburgh is left with a very checkered history, both of feeling extraordinarily powerful and on top of the world on one level, and at the same time, feeling like a place of deep shame. And, you know, that one of the things that happens with steel is you produce a great deal of waste. So we have what are called mountains of slag that have been dominating some of the environments around here. All the refuse that you take off the cookers when you're making steel. So part of it is that we hold a tradition of, you know, feeling extremely proud and at the same time extremely ashamed, all at the same time. That you put that in combination with this, you know, belief in hard work and a certain kind of combativeness. And what happened when the mills went was an environment in which all of the rules that people had been living with were gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they were left to try to figure out how to completely fend for themselves in a situation where things had been done much more collectively. I think it's been an extraordinarily hard adjustment. It's also, I think, led us to be very uncertain. I mean, it probably took, I'd say only recently have people begun to think that, you know, the mills really aren't going to come back. That idea of a steel city, whatever that was, that really is now history. The flip side of all this is, you know, we still make steel here. So you know, we don't want to give up this idea that we are a place that makes steel and that we're a manufacturing town. The problem is it's just not going to employ a lot of people. And the end result of that has been lots of people left. Young people had to leave for work, so that's made it very hard on families because this was a place that, in part because of that grittiness and that hard-nosed, you know, solidarity, you know, people sort of anticipated being able to be around their families. It's one of the places that people generally don't like to leave, and when they move away, they move away under duress. They'd love to come back.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dr. Kenneth Thompson. He's an associate professor of psychiatry and public health at the University of Pittsburgh and has written a report based on the first International Steel Cities Conference. Tell me who else was at the conference. Which other cities were represented?
This conference was actually was inspired by a couple of, interestingly enough, a couple of folks who study regional dialect. The primary mover was a professor of linguistics at the University of Sheffield by the name of Joan Beale in England. Well, it turns out that Pittsburgh and a lot of these steel cities develop a very particular kind of accent. Not that they're similar to each other, but that they're distinct. She and another professor of rhetoric here at Carnegie Mellon University, Barbara Johnson, met at a conference and said, wouldn't it be interesting to have people who are from steel cities get together? they organized this conference, we had folks from a number of steel cities in the United States, some folks obviously from Britain and Sheffield, which is the sort of the hometown of the old British steel industry. There were folks from Northwest Spain, people from Turkey, Belgium, Sweden, probably a couple of other countries that I'm not recalling right at the top, right at the second.
Were some of the cities represented there handling the transition more gracefully than others?
You know, it's a little hard to tell without going there. My sense was that Sheffield and some of the British towns had an easier time of it than perhaps Pittsburgh. I think that a lot of these places had begun to see the collapse as also an opportunity to reinvent their cities and to try to figure out how they would fit into a new economy model. You know, certainly the sense that we got was that places were not as desperate as parts of Pittsburgh and parts of Cleveland are today. So my sense was, yes, there are some opportunities that some places have taken out of this change that have actually been at least help the cities in these regions find a slightly better equilibrium than we have in the old Rust Belt here.
Is there something similar here to stages of grief? You talked about the fact that Pittsburgh only recently has come to believe as a community the mills aren't coming back. So there has to be acceptance before you can create a new future and figure out how you fit into the new economy model. Can you discern stages around this acceptance and then moving on?
Absolutely. I think that the mills closing, or you know, any time a place is very heavily dependent on a particular way of making a living, it's essentially a disaster. It's a major trauma for the community. And it takes a process that people have to go through. That's very much what grief is about. Grief is about loss and then coming to terms with the fact that there are still things and ways of living in life that can be fulfilling despite the loss. One of the things that they've done in Germany is, and also to some degree in the UK, is that they've created a movement around public art that attempts to commemorate what this industry was about and the sort of heroic struggles of the people who were involved in it. So they've created public art that commemorates the loss of these industries and a way to say, okay, now it's time to move on to the future. I was able to go to Britain in Newcastle, Gateshead, which is an old, essentially a metals town where they made ships, and that industry completely collapsed. They created something called the Angel of the North, which is a mammoth structure on top of a hill. Looks like a huge, neutered human being made of steel girders with wings. People would make a point of stopping at some point and saying, can you see the Angel of the North from here? And they'd point it out to me and they'd say, you know, things like, that's the symbol of what we once were, and it's also the symbol of what we're going to become. It's a work of imagination that allows them to imagine the future.
Mm. Well, let's talk about imagining the future in a city like a steel city where, again, that imagery is so, it's so powerful. And I'm wondering how you replace that with an equally powerful image of a future that is not yet known, that you cannot yet see.
I think we're, you know, struggling to figure that out. There's a certain sense in these places that I've run into that, you know, that's the past. We want to escape it as fast as we possibly can. We don't want people to think about Pittsburgh being the old smoky city. It's a, you know, it's a gleaming new city of the future. In terms of being a source of mass employment, it's not going to be that. We need to be a different kind of city with a different kind of innovation, which in many ways, the whole process of creating the steel industry to begin with was about. It was about innovation. It was about lots of different kinds of things that people were trying. It was about entrepreneurship. It was about being global. It was about really being creative. And I think that's the part that we need to find again in this city. Part of where I really began to wonder about the mass psychology of this, or the process that the whole region's going through, is just the fanatical devotion people have to the Steelers, in part because the Steelers have been capturing the desire to stand out that this city had for many years and did through steel and now can't do except through sports. We have extraordinary fans here, and I would love to try to figure out how to take that capacity to be a fan and generate that into a kind of regional civic participation in the rebirth of the region.
Don't you think in some ways, Ken, it relates exactly to what you said, and that is underlying Steel City was a set of capabilities that are still as relevant today as they were then, creativity, entrepreneurship, innovation. Don't you think then that helps people today see how it's not hopeless, it's not impossible, in fact, it's just the continuation of a tradition?
Right. I mean, the steel cities were created by people exercising those qualities, as well as, you know, stuff I've indicated before as well, you know, hard work and a certain solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's not that we didn't make problems for ourselves. You know, the conflicts between the social classes, the conflicts between African Americans and white folks, and I mean, we've got lots of things that we didn't do as well as we could have. We've got an opportunity to do them better. We could take the same values, and if we can apply them in a different way and in a way that is hopefully creates a better future for everybody here, I think it would be an extraordinarily powerful mix. The problem is that people had those values, or many of those values, and saw them dashed when things fell apart here. And they have had a hard time sort of realizing that in some ways it wasn't that the values were wrong. It was that the one thing that we probably did as a region that was problematic is that we got sort of self-assured, probably a little bit unwilling to pay attention to what was going on in the rest of the world. I think that what Pittsburgh has to realize is that we need to be a source of great international attention, but maybe not to be the focus, but to be connected into the world very dramatically in lots of different ways. One of the speakers at the conference was a guy named David Blunkett. At the time of the 80s, was a socialist mayor of Sheffield, a young guy, totally blind since birth, very, very bright and very impressive guy. But his point about steel cities was that they can't capitulate entirely to the world that's around them, nor can they fight against the world all the time. What they need to do is to take their capacities, their skills, and their what they've learned in their gut from this process that we've been talking about, and engage the world, and try to help shape the world as they have in the past and reshape themselves.
Are there more discussions planned with this group?
We are very interested in having a second Steel Cities conference here in Pittsburgh, hopefully during the 250th anniversary of the city. And we would love to be host and assume, I think, what would be a rightful place of developing leadership among these cities, which have both gone through being steel cities and are now in some ways ex-steel cities, similar to ourselves, as well as cities that are, you know, now evolving in India and China and South America as steel cities, to start a conversation about, you know, what's the history of this industry, how do people relate to it, and what's going to happen to the communities that participate in it. Because there are some things, I think, that our founding fathers here in this steel city did that were very good. We created a lot of institutions that have really carried us over, and we have perhaps more foundations than any place in the United States. So there have been good things that have been created and left behind, and maybe we can help other people think about that. The folks in Britain, I think, may have had some better ideas about how to deal with the actual wrenching transition. So we hope to share these ideas with other places. The dilemma that we're facing right now is that there are folks in this particular region who would say, well, you know, that's our old heritage. We don't really want to focus on that at the moment.
Ken, I find it, a fascinating topic. I'm so glad you were willing to share it with us on Smart City. Thanks for being with us. Dr. Kenneth Thompson is an associate professor of psychiatry and public health at the University of Pittsburgh. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, my daughter, has lived in a number of major U.S. cities. She's single, and the one constant in her life is her chocolate lab, Austin. And one way she evaluates cities is how dog-friendly they are, and apparently she's not the only one.
No, and cities need to be dog-friendly. It's because as much as we welcome people, people with dogs are even more welcome, particularly in urban areas. Let me explain. In Los Angeles, the downtown, as you may know, is very small and has struggled for as long as I can remember. It is starting to come back. People are starting to move into the downtown area, but it's still a little bit of an urban frontier. There is an army of homeless people camped out in downtown Los Angeles. One of the things that the authorities say has really helped in LA is that these newcomers are bringing their dogs. Now, why would it matter to a city whether you came or you came with your dog? The answer is, if you and I feel a little uncertain about the urban environment, we can just wall ourselves up in our condos or our houses, watch TV, never go out, and the streets could just continue to deteriorate. But the dogs require that you go outside at least twice a day. You have to walk the dog. As it turns out, dog owners, because they know they have to go out every day twice, are very diligent about reporting problems because they don't want to run into that same dangerous drug transaction happening a second time. So they'll call the cops. Dogs are also make other people, law-abiding people, feel safer. When you see someone walking a big dog, or even sometimes a small dog downtown, you look at them and you say, there's a sign of normality. That makes me feel more comfortable about this area. And obviously it gives some comfort, as it does for your daughter, just to have a large dog around, and makes them feel bolder about living in uncertain places. So for all those reasons, you know, Jane Jacobs used to talk about eyes on the streets. Well, it helps to have a few nice, big, sensitive noses on the streets as well. And so we need to encourage dogs.
We do indeed. In fact, I did a piece of research last year which showed a spinoff benefit, not the one you're talking about. But in fact, if you tried to find activities that would correlate with active living, would stimulate people to be active during their daily lives, not go to the health club, not run, jog, bike, but rather in their daily lives, what could they do to be most active? We found the highest correlation with dog ownership.
Absolutely. You know, we are a nation dealing with obesity, and walking your dog is a very good form of exercise.
That's right, because you can't ignore it, you can't deny it, you can't say I'm too tired. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist with Governing Magazine. After a short break, we'll talk with Larry Keeley, thought leader at Doblin, about the results from the Urban Innovation Workshops Larry and his firm produced earlier this year with CEOs for cities for leaders in Pittsburgh, Detroit, Columbus, and Memphis Shelby County. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Larry Keeley is an innovation strategist who is co-founder, president, and thought leader at Doblin. This summer, Larry led a series of urban innovation workshops to introduce the concepts of innovation to leaders in four cities. He's a frequent lecturer and teacher about frontiers of innovation and strategy with posts at Kellogg and the University of Chicago. Larry has worked with such companies as Aetna, Apple, Citigroup, ExxonMobil, Hallmark, McDonald's, Motorola, and Pfizer. He's a board member for the Institute of Design at Illinois Institute of Technology, where he's also an adjunct professor teaching graduate design strategy classes. He's also a board member for WBEZ-FM in Chicago. Larry is author of The Taming of the New, a guide to the new disciplines of innovation to be published soon by Harvard Business School Press. Larry, explain the purpose of the urban innovation workshops.
Like innovation workshops in any case, the whole idea was to try to get the people most closely connected to the situation, to have the skills, the competence, and frankly the courage to try to do something bold and transformational.
Tell me about the process you attempted to teach urban leaders in these workshops.
It started with giving the people that came from four different regions some grounding in innovation fundamentals, why innovation is different than people think, why it's harder than people think, why it tends to fail rather than to succeed, all designed to root out the bad habits that are almost universal about any of us when we try to innovate. That was the first section. It culminated in the sharing of diagnostics about what kinds of patterns of actions are happening in cities all over the world. There was a second workshop that had to do with crafting an innovation intent, trying to come up with a major goal, a way to think about what would be distinctive and different in each of the four respective regions. And then we worked further in a final workshop to craft the right kinds of bold, transformational, newsworthy initiatives that would deliver on those intentions.
Why does innovation often fail?
Most people conflate innovation with creativity. They think they're the same topic, and they think that if they're simply more creative, they will get more outrageous, out-of-the-box kinds of answers. They think that innovation is simple, about the creation of some new product. They think it is mostly lacking because somehow or other they as individuals aren't creative enough. These and so many other common habits we have turn out to be often shared even by some innovation experts, but they are terribly unproductive.
What constitutes a bold idea?
Well, first off, although it seems sort of paradoxical, these days almost all of us need to do something to get our unfair share of attention. And if you think about it that way, you start to discover the, again, counterintuitive principle that a small number of really big ideas is much more valuable than a large number of little ideas. It's the big ideas that thrill us. It's the big ideas that journalists will write a story about. It's the big ideas that make us proud to live in a particular city. I live in Chicago, where the Millennium Park is so thrilling that people all around the region are very proud to be associated with a city that would have such a path-breaking park. And the park changes how we live together, brings together wealthy people and not wealthy people, brings together every race and every class. And you see people having a joyous time together, and you're really proud of the city for having the vision, the guts, and the citizen-led initiatives that cause that to come to life. These are the things we want in a city. These are the things that we want in the ways that we live together, even in a business. Ideas that are thrilling, that change the way we live, that give us a sense of new possibilities. That conflicts often with the temptation to try to do something that somehow or other we can prove will get a financial return on investment, preferably in the first month or two after we launch it. Big ideas are difficult, of course, to achieve, but paradoxically, they're the safest and the smartest to pursue.
You mentioned Millennium Park. What do you think about the move that so many cities are now making to build new museums designed by star architects?
That obviously started with the Guggenheim and Bilbao by Frank Gehry. I no longer think of it as a particularly bold idea. I mean, when Frank Gehry did the Guggenheim and Bilbao, it was so costly, both for the Guggenheim Museum as an entity and for the city of Bilbao, that frankly it terrified locals. You know, they were spending a vast amount of money on something that was largely decoupled from the way in which that mostly industrial city made its money. And yet it paid off huge. What you have to expect is that the rise of starchitects, the Santiago Calatravas and the Frank Gehrys and the Rem Koolhaases of our time, you've got to expect that people will get diminishing marginal returns with those high-profile installations. We'll get a little bit of fatigue about either the fundraising or the construction or the payment. On the other hand, let's give credit where credit is due. Truly talented architects bring a lot of value to the projects that they take on. And truly talented design teams completely construct an experience that will be memorable for people. And we do want that. No one should ever be making a case for bland buildings that are affordable. You know, no one needs government-led design or systems that give us, you know, the joys of cinder block buildings of no particular distinction with all the warmth and charm of an airport washroom. What we want instead is experiences in the city that make it worth our while to put up with the miseries of living there. And architects and great design teams can still do that. What I'm suggesting is that just using a star architect may be necessary but not sufficient anymore for getting your unfair share of attention. Probably have to go a little further and figure out what's coming after that.
Speaking again, Larry, about the workshops, tell me what worked.
Well, the thing that worked most, of course, is that the individuals that came from cities like Detroit and Columbus and Pittsburgh and Memphis or Shelby County, is that the individuals themselves knew they had to do something with courage and with vision at a level that was sufficiently fresh and powerful that it would inspire the local citizens. The individuals that came made it successful. The techniques we gave them, I think, kept them from wasting a moment of their time and helped them to know, in the enormous ambiguity that surrounds innovation, what is the smallest number of actions you should take that are highly correlated with success. It was kind of mechanical, what we provided. What they provided was heart and courage and a willingness to try to align government leaders and citizens and sources of funding around the ideas that they themselves crafted in successive workshops.
What could have worked better?
It would have been nicer to have much more of a citizen-led and government-endorsed initiative in some of those cases. Occasionally, what we got was people who didn't have the real clout to get things done or didn't put enough into it to get out of it something that was remarkable. What I think is interesting is how one city in particular, Columbus, which had done a tremendous strategic planning effort with the help of Michael Porter and the Monitor Consulting Organization, they had done tremendous amounts of work in advance to know what they were trying to achieve. And in that case, I think the end result that they got was much more tangible, much more connected to a performance shift that they were trying to engineer. Knowing what they were trying to do helped them to be very intensely focused and, frankly, very demanding in the way that they undertook it. Others, I think, might have hit it with a little bit too small a hammer. Innovation is not for the faint-hearted. You got to come prepared to work hard. And in the ideal case, government leaders should be conspiring with local citizen leaders, business leaders, and others to try to make sure that they take innovation as seriously as they undertake anything else that they do.
Are you suggesting that innovation can't happen within government?
I would never suggest such a thing. I think governments throughout history have innovated, but typically they do it when the going gets tough and the status quo isn't working and a calamity is in their midst, right? I think it's harder when you're in the ordinary course of business to decide to do something completely differently. And if you think about everybody else, not just government leaders, we all live that way. If what we do Monday through Friday is more or less working, even if it's not thrilling, we tend to trudge along doing our best. It's actually hard for people to say, I'm not satisfied with the status quo. I want to do something completely different. I don't know how to do the different thing. Where can I get some help with that?
You had four cities participate. What did each of the cities focus on?
Detroit thoughtfully focused on, you know, sort of human expression. When you think about Detroit, it's a city that's having a bit of a rough patch right now, so innovation is important to them. They explored a wide variety of interesting ideas, like smart highway systems to reinforce the idea of being the motor city. Why not engineer the world's coolest traffic systems? But ultimately, they chose to have their innovations focus on the expressions of young people, the authentic voices that come from lots of different social classes and lots of different races, that would give them the chance to build consciously one more time an entirely new genre of music and entertainment. I think a very gutsy choice and an interesting one, and it fuses arts with city-led initiatives. Memphis Shelby County focused on the ways in which they could combine a variety of educational resources locally with business opportunities locally and to create what they came to call a career ladder, a way to specifically integrate the actions of business, education, and the government to try to be conscious about what kinds of career tracks to create, to feature, and to integrate around. So they're trying to take away all the friction to learning the kinds of things that are going to be uniquely situated in that region. In Pittsburgh, we focused on the elderly and what we could do to make in the north a city that was really compelling for people that were in their third age of life, as some people call it, how to create the kind of activities and environments and neighborhoods and, you know, arts activities that would really be welcoming to people who are elderly and to provide the city services that would support that. And Columbus focused on trying to create a great way to discover the future, specifically with the 100,000 young students that are there at Ohio State, and in a way that would be smart about advising and providing insights for businesses of various kinds. All four of these ideas, by the way, distinctly different from one another, distinctly different from what other cities are focused on. Every one of those four ideas can become newsworthy and the best of its kind anywhere in the world. And in that sense, they reflect what I know to be smart, bold ambitions combined with tangible, focused, vivid actions.
Are those reasonable intentions?
On the surface, all four ideas are valid. But let's be cautious. As hard as it is to get a great idea, and as much as that requires a special discipline, the most perilous times for an innovation come shortly after that bold idea is authored. Because that's when a steady parade of very smart people will arrive and give you all kinds of reasonable sounding reasons why the idea is unworkable, undesirable, not affordable, or just plain nuts. And you need to do a variety of things in the earliest, foggiest stages of the development of a new idea to de-risk it further. So I'm cautiously optimistic. I know that all four cities had some success in developing what I would call their innovation muscles, but they still have to go in the ring and fight a few rounds.
Larry, where do you begin developing an innovation intent? Is it around a strength, a weakness, the future? Where is it?
The whole idea of an innovation intent is so logical when you stop and think about it that it's stunning that more people don't talk about it. If you've got talented individuals, and my starting position is that everybody is talented if you give them a shot. If you give those talented individuals just a little bit of help, if you tell them what itch you're trying to scratch, if you tell them what is strategically valuable to us in this region, this business, this situation, those individuals can then concentrate their talent, concentrate their firepower on achieving the most valuable thing. This is what I call high protocol innovation, and it's the dead opposite of the normal way we're told to innovate, right? Go nuts, think outside the box, don't hold back, generate scores, possibly hundreds of ideas. No idea is too crazy for us. This is the standard way we do it. And I think that that's just nuts. Leaders need to lead. And the thing you need to do to give your innovation teams a fighting chance at being great is to spend enough time to identify the needs of the business or region in order to make sure that no moments are wasted and no talent is left unchallenged or undirected around a goal that you've carefully determined is valuable. To your specific question, Carol, which was very thoughtful, it really doesn't matter whether you do it to accentuate your strengths or to flip adversity to advantage because you're addressing a weakness. What matters is that you have a point of view and you know what you're trying to achieve with innovation. Because when you don't know what you're trying to achieve with innovation, you have no basis for either saying when an idea is great or when it's not so great. And it leads to costly, ambiguous, and ultimately unsuccessful efforts to sort out the wheat from the chaff.
What surprised you in working with cities?
I have to say, honestly, nothing terribly surprised me. I think what might have surprised them is the belief that I was trying to share that every city could be great at something. That every city could be, or region could be, the best in the world at something, and that the whole name of the game was choosing, and that there are smart, thoughtful ways to make those choices. I'm still not convinced that each of our four regions have taken that particular lesson to heart and have committed enough to make those choices and then to persist and simply persist in trying to deliver on the results. But nothing surprised me other than it was a delight to see the realization dawning after one or two and finally three workshops that innovation is something that anybody can master, that when you do it with discipline, and when you do it with intensity, you get results.
Did you find working in cities similar to working in corporations?
Yes, and I find it similar to working with any human being that sort of is in pain, right? Boy, the status quo isn't working. I want to do something different, but I don't know how, and I haven't had any, you know, success of that, and I don't consider myself a creative person. This is the sort of pain lots of people find themselves in when they want to innovate. And it's also hydraulically pressured by the vague sense most of us have that we live in an intense time of change and that innovation is a vaguely malevolent force happening all around us, but not in the active choices that we're making. We're not succeeding at it. We're being victimized by it. What I think is interesting and different about working with cities in this particular case is that we had to do it with four simultaneously. So it was a bit of a four-ring circus. We tried to make as much of a virtue of that as we could by holding forth the lessons of any one city so that all three other cities at any moment could see the similarities and the differences, the themes and the variations.
Many organizations realize that quality is now the price of admission, and they've Six Sigma'd everything in sight. So they've squeezed out the extra cost, and they're now efficient. So they're looking to innovate as the next step. But most people, most organizations don't really know where to begin. Where do they begin?
Well, it's a great point that you're making. You know, none of us wants to tolerate, as citizens and taxpayers, inefficiency. So, you know, sort of job one is run the region well. And I think what happens to people after they do the hard work of trying to be serious about being efficient, having their websites and leveraging the internet, trying to be interactive and sort of vaguely centered around the actions that citizens want to take, not asking people to put up with stupid processes that waste the time of citizens, not making it, frankly, hard for the citizens to comply with the law or to be a good member of the community. What comes after that, of course, just as you surmise, is the sense that we owe it to one another to actively consider how we want to live and to build places like that. What comes first? The creation of a team that understands that it's their responsibility to work with a mayor. It's their responsibility to respond to the citizens' unmet needs, including the ones the citizens haven't lined up to articulate yet. You see, the greatness in innovation is when we learn to do things that people never knew to ask us for, but soon thereafter discovered they really would rather not live without.
Larry, how can leaders find the space to take risks? Elected leaders have constituents with a long list of things they do know they want, and so they feel compelled to respond to them, particularly within an election cycle. So how do leaders find the space to take risks?
I think it starts with a burning personal goal in the part of leaders to simply not be a caretaker, to not be ordinary, to do something that makes a mark, that reminds people that in a time of change, somebody tried to anticipate what was a little further down the road. Somebody tried to do something that helped us to see in a time of uncertainty, a time of nervousness, that we can assert what it means to be human, what it means to be living together in a place. I think great leaders have that impulse natively. They want to not be ordinary. They want to have somebody remember that they made a difference. Great leaders often have a vague, hard-to-define, intuitive sense of the pain points that people are suffering and maybe the opportunities that would be newsworthy and different. What I think is important to do is to take that kind of leadership, which I don't think can be taught, and to give it the support systems and the counterintuitive discoveries that make it easier and less risky to try those bold things.
Thanks, Larry, for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
Larry Keeley is an innovation strategist with Doblin. A city's skyline can communicate to the casual observer much about the values and priorities on which the city was founded. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith shares his hometown insights gleaned from an afternoon in the sun.
One of my favorite places to spend an afternoon is an open-air rooftop restaurant in Charleston, South Carolina. It has a 360-degree view of the city, the bay, and the bridges that cross over to barrier islands nearby. There's no better place for getting a good perspective on the city of Charleston. Charleston is a low-rise city. Only a few complexes rise higher than the rest. Mostly, though, life in Charleston is lived at street level. The historic old slave market, jam-packed with vendors and craftsmen. the Battery Park on the water at the easternmost point of the city, the maze of alleyways and streets filled with restaurants and art galleries, the horse-drawn carriages, walking tours, and pedicabs. Nothing dwarfs this life on the street. Yet while the heart of Charleston is at ground level, its soul soars high above. This, too, is seen from that restaurant because sticking up in every direction are the steeples of the churches of Charleston. Charleston is known as the Holy City and has often been described as the home of religious freedom in America. The first laws of the Carolinas guaranteed the most religious freedom of any of the 13 original colonies, so people of all faiths and denominations flocked to Charleston. St. Philip's Episcopal Church was established in 1670. St. Michael's Episcopal Church was established nearly 100 years later and continues today in the oldest church building in the city. The French Protestant Church stands on the site where French Huguenots have worshipped since 1687. The oldest synagogue in continuous use in the U.S. is in Charleston. The Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church goes back to the late 1700s and the establishment of the Free African Society, which included both freedmen and slaves. Baptist churches in the South trace their family tree back to the First Baptist Church of Charleston, which grew out of a small congregation that left Maine in the late 1600s to worship in a more tolerant religious environment. Many, many historic churches like this grace Charleston's skyline. Not that Charleston has been completely spared from religious intolerance. Catholics, for example, were generally unwelcome, and racial fears in the early 1800s led to mass arrest of AME church members and the burning of some of their churches. For the most part, though, Charleston has been a city where people of many different faiths and denominations have flourished and worshipped side by side. A city where church steeples rising overhead are the most distinctive feature of the city's skyline. This is what you can see from that rooftop restaurant in Charleston, a panorama capturing both the heart and soul of the city, both the life teeming below and the spirit soaring above. In every city, we should seek out a place like this to sit and get some perspective. Whatever our involvement in the life of a city, to understand it, to put it into place, to connect with both its heart and soul, we need the context and perspective of a place with a view. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.